A halt to offshore oil and gas leasing in the Arctic has raised the ire of offshore development supporters, but is this really important for Alaska's fiscal future? Oil prices are on life support, and the price of LNG doesn't yet make the math work for a big gas line project for cash export. So what's the answer for an oil money-dependent state like Alaska to stay solvent? How to keep Alaska's golden goose thriving is our topic today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Linfield College in Oregon offers degrees in the arts, sciences, and professional programs, and a rich campus life with athletics, music, study abroad, and more. Linfield College representatives are visiting area high schools in Anchorage, Kenai, and Fairbanks the week of October 20th. Learn more at linfield.edu. This message sponsored by Linfield College.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. The world is currently awash in low-priced oil and gas. This will change at some point in the future as demand gobbles up supply. But even when it does, will Alaska, the one-time powerhouse of domestic oil production, again be a big player in barrels per day? What's the prospect for new oil production here? How long will it be until the price of LNG makes it feasible for a gas line? And why can't we diversify the economy enough to wean us off our oil dollar dependence? What about good-paying jobs for Alaskans in the future? Here to help us examine these questions are Mark Myers. Good morning. Mark is the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Also, Kara Moriarty is the president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association and is also in the studio. Thanks, Kara, for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Lois Epstein is a petroleum engineer and the Arctic Program Manager for the Wilderness Society. Hi, Lois.
Hi, Laura. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for being here, and you out there in listener land can also join our conversation if you'd like to. We're talking about the financial fiscal health of Alaska into the future. Our number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. Locally in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Mark, I'd like to start with you. You were just in Washington, D.C., talking to federal regulators about Alaska resources. Were you focused on oil or gas, or was it kind of a mix?
It was a mix. Also discussing issues around federal and state land policy, working through issues, obviously, since the federal government owns such a large portion of Alaska, the state next, the Native corporations next, it's really good for us to do compare notes so we manage the landscape appropriately. So there's some of that discussion, but part of it was working through issues with the LNG project and also working on issues potentially on federal lands and the potential for oil and gas development.
You were in Greenland recently for a State Department workshop on natural resource development. What was that focus?
Well, it was sponsored by the State Department, which funded my trip over there. It's interesting, as you look around the Arctic nations, all of them, the ones that have oil and gas potential and minerals potential, are looking at exploiting it to build sustainability into their government. So there is no easy path for the Greenland people to gain independence. It's a very small 38,000 people on a landmass that's bigger than Alaska. It's rich with resources. It's also rich with environmental value. So they are looking and exploring, and the State Department's helping them describe, when they want look at mining and oil and gas operations, what are kind of best practices? How does the government build sustainability through oil and gas? And what has worked and hasn't worked? So I was there to kind of explain, both with respect to mining and oil and gas, sort of what the state policies have been, what the challenges and issues are, all the way from how do we build collaborative environmental work and sustainability, community support in there, but also how do the economic models work? You know, how does royalty and taxes work? What works and what doesn't work? From an Alaska perspective, there are other people there from academics and other countries explaining their models too. So it was a collaborative workshop to look at best practices circumarctic for oil and gas and mineral development and how that can be used to benefit, in the case of Greenland, independence, but in case of other places, sustainability of economies.
Are they in full going forward, or are they just planning at this point with the way that prices are for fossil fuel development right now? Where are they in this process?
In Greenland? Or?
Yes.
So in Greenland, they've had a series of explorations. They have a series of licenses out there. They have not found commercial hydrocarbons. And they're wondering, as things move forward in the lower price environment, how active exploration activities will be. They're also looking at diversifying into mining. So they're, you know, was interesting to hear their aspirational goal was to have four or five large working mines in terms of providing, you know, economy of to build a basically nation building economy, which is about what Alaska has, you know. So their aspirational goal was to have the level of development that we have. And so we talked about the differences. And one of the things that's striking is oil and gas simply brings in much more dollars than mining does. Mining has a lot of good attributes with respect to economics of a community, local taxation, but it just doesn't bring in the revenue worldwide that oil and gas does. So there was a compare and contrast, just realistically. And again, I'm not suggesting that our system's the best system by any stretch of the imagination, but we have a history, as does Norway and some other countries. So they were looking at how those sorts of economic development things can be done in a sustainable fashion, how local government is able to put input into that, concerns of their Inupiat communities as well. So it was really kind of an overlay of the same issues Alaska had to face. And so it was a very, very fun dialogue, actually.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking about Alaska's energy future. Mark, I want to stay with you just for a moment. Other recent D.C. meetings have involved the methane hydrate research. Excuse me. We haven't heard a lot about that recently. There was a lot of talk about it at one point in time. I know that the late Senator Stevens talked a lot about the potential for methane hydrates. What is the potential there currently, and what would it take to realize it?
Well, there's a huge potential. If you look at worldwide sources of hydrocarbons and carbon in general as an energy source, hydrates are the largest source. They surpass coal. They surpass all oil and gas known in the world, including conventional and unconventional. They also exist in places in unique environmental conditions where certain temperature and pressure environments exist. And one of those is in relatively deep ocean waters, and that's in the Gulf of Mexico. But it's also in places like offshore Japan, offshore Korea, offshore India. So there's a lot of interest in those countries that don't have traditional fossil fuel resources, particularly natural gas, to look and understand what that resource is like. So there's been, if you look at the history of oil and gas development, particularly unconventional, there was a significant investment by the Department of Energy and other federal agencies in understanding the technology, understanding the classifying, how do you classify what's producible resources, what's not, and then what are the technology barriers toward production, what are the safety issues. Additionally, natural gas hydrates, as we warm the oceans, as you warm the temperature of the seafloor by warmer ocean currents, it changes the stability fuel and releases methane into the ocean environments naturally. So we have a naturally occurring climate process that introduces methane into by significant quantities of methane into the ocean. And there's a real debate in the scientific community about how much of that methane that's introduced to the ocean by natural processes of warming, how much that gets released to the atmosphere, and how does that affect greenhouse gas balance. So there's two parts to the hydrate research program. One is understanding the resource, which, again, the largest source on the planet that we know of methane, and secondly, understanding the climate effects. And so I sit on the Federal Advisory Committee for this program, and we're reviewing the program on behalf of the Secretary of Energy. So I was in meetings with the Secretary going through evaluating that. We have an upcoming report that's being generated by his Energy Advisory Board for the Secretary to look at recommendations for improving the program and recommendations for levels of support for the federal government. So in Alaska, we have a large amount of hydrates associated with permafrost. So in most places in the world, the hydrates are offshore. In Alaska, they're both offshore and onshore. And onshore, a significant portion of what we know exists in the Prudhoe Bay and Kuparik and Milne Point oil fields. So we really want to get a long-term test. And the test is really, if you can test them onshore, it's that much cheaper, that much easier. We can get long-term results, and the gas can then be used for fuel operations. So we have a place to test fundamental science out in terms of how the reservoirs perform, what technology is needed, how producible are they, what are the characteristics to produce it. So Alaska is the best place in the world to run a test to understand the some basic scientific information. So part of the work that was being done is, can we get that fundamental science data? And then that also will help define the Alaska resource, but will tell us worldwide what this resource is. So one of the questions I asked the Secretary of Energy is, how important is this an international resource? Because, again, if you look at Lower 48, we know we have gas supplies for decades, potential in the current proven resource. So why would we study hydrates? And one of the reasons is it has huge geopolitical significance, not just to Alaska but to the world.
Right.
So generally, working through those issues, giving him a very scientifically derived series of recommendations is an ongoing process. So that's ongoing. At the same time, a lot of positive work has been done. The Japanese are very interested, and there's work on the North Slope funded, which will cost about $15 million, $5 million from the Department of Energy, $10 million from the Japanese, from JOGMEC, their corporation, to do a long-term, hoofully two-year production test in the Prudhoe Bay area. So a lot of work's being done to look at the seismic data, pick a location, to work collaboratively with the industry, and also the U.S. Geological Survey, again, the Japanese, and the state of Alaska working together technologically. And so DOE, USGS, the state, and the Japanese are all working collaboratively together to pick a location, and we've gotten great cooperation from the operators to look at shared seismic data and look at potentially either Hillcore operating in Milne Point or BP operating in Prudhoe Bay. And so anyway, it's really encouraging. We're moving forward systematically, largely funded through government and Japanese funding, but supported by industry.
When you talk about the geopolitical implications, I'm assuming that part of that, at least, is the problem with methane leaching into the atmosphere. It's much better if it can be sequestered in the ground or in the seabed floor, but as things warm, we know that it's being released, so the next best option is then to gather and burn it, I would assume. So is that what you're talking about, and where is the process as far as actually being able to develop past studies?
A little bit different than that. So at one level, the hydrates that would be produced in Alaska in the long term, if in fact we can produce them commercially, are at deep depths. They're below at the base of permafrost, so they're several thousand feet down. There's no near term or even in the century that we're going to see that much permafrost or that stability field changed. There are other hydrates that form. The methane doesn't come from deep oil and gas sources. It comes from biogenic activity at the seafloor. Those hydrates that get captured or by microbes, you know, near the sediment water interface, those hydrates then aren't a different. They're widely dispersed across the seafloor. And as we warm the ocean, what happens is the hydrate, as you raise the temperature, the hydrate stability field changes, and hydrates go from a solid form to a gaseous form. And some of that hydrate then gets released to the ocean and beyond. So we need to understand both those processes. So the program looks at both of those. The basic environmental impact that's happening globally with respect to what, how do hydrates contribute to ocean acidification, carbon cycle processes, and atmospheric greenhouse gases, and a separate program that looks at those hydrates that might be producible separately that are really not at risk of being destabilized but are in deeper locations where it's more optimized for commercial production. So really separate goals. It gets confusing, but so they're both important aspects of the program.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to have my other two guests here weigh in on this before we move on to other things. Kara, Mark Myers was talking, our DNR commissioner was talking about the industry being involved in this research. Do you have an update on or a comment on who is involved in it and what you're hearing from them?
Well, I think as the commissioner said, I think the example of the large amount of methanes just shows what a mega resource the Prudhoe Bay field and Kuparuk and surrounding fields have been for Alaska, whether it's been oil, natural gas opportunities, methane. We have another thing you didn't talk about that he knows more about than I do is our heavy oil and our viscous oil. I think it just points that it is a mega, mega resource. But some of these opportunities are really long ways out. And so, you know, the operators of Prudhoe and now Milne, because it's under new ownership, obviously want to be cooperative, but our focus is on the commercial assets at the moment.
Sure.
But we know that it's a resource-rich field. It always has been, and there's opportunities, hopefully, for many generations to come.
Mm-hmm. Lois, a comment about
sure. As Mark said, there are two aspects of the issue. One is what's going on naturally and what kind of contribution that is going to have to climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, and then the commercial aspect, which we heard is very far in the future. So what I would say the conservation community is paying attention to is the overall picture having to do with climate change and greenhouse gas emissions and carbon-based fuels, and focusing as much as possible on modernizing the energy system both in Alaska and elsewhere so that we move towards cleaner forms of energy production.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the future of energy in Alaska, a state heavily, heavily dependent on fossil fuel dollars and looking toward the future. And can we wean ourselves from that and find a new way to stabilize the economy here so it's not so subject to the ups and downs of the market? You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, or locally 550-8422. 550-8422. There's been criticism over the Obama administration pulling back on offering new offshore leases. If you look purely at the economics, though, doesn't it make sense to hold off on lease sales, at least until the price of oil rebounds? Mark?
Well, I think one of the things to pay real attention to is the cyclic nature of oil and gas investment. So if you looked at the Chukchi Sea in particular, where Chukchi and Beaufort Sea is the drilling that occurred this year was the first new well in Chukchi Sea since 91, and that was when Shell drilled the original Berger prospect. So they found gas. They thought they had a significant oil leg. Turns out that it looks like, based on the information they have released publicly, that there was a leak in the system, a fault or some other mechanism, that the oil was in the prospect. They were right technically, but then it migrated out. Remember back, the Muckluck well had the same thing way back, and we thought we had a Prudhoe Bay look-alike, and Sahil spent a lot of money. Turned out there was a small leak in the system. So it doesn't disprove the basin. It just shows that that particular prospect didn't turn out as expected. And that's the majority of the cases when you look at exploration. It doesn't mean the basin doesn't have the hydrocarbons we expect there. It just means one prospect failed. And that's the history of Alaska. Prudhoe Bay was the last well of a multi-well program drilled. Our first oil well actually in Alaska was drilled in 1898. It wasn't until 1911 we had first production at Catala. So you see this episodic drilling, failure, come back, relook at it, process. The challenge is that, and typically when the prices are higher, the companies have more capital and they take more risk and they drill these wildcat exploration wells. If the leases aren't available, the time span it takes to reacquire the leases, the fact that their sunk investment isn't valid anymore because everyone else will have the data at some point, hurts their willingness to spend this kind of money. So the state's position, the governor's position has been, we would like to see them be able to keep the leases, even if they're going to be active right away, to give them a chance when prices rebound and there's more time. We know oil prices are cyclic. They always have been. We're going to see ups and downs. We're going to see more capital available for investment for exploration in the future based on a lot of history in these cycles. So given that, we think, and the state thinks it's important for let them to maintain those leases for a period of time, keep the active processes going. Leasing brings in money, but not like development does, because, again, the royalties and taxes off development far exceed. So if you look at it from an economic standpoint, getting the wells drilled and the development occurring is really the star of the show, not the acquiring the leases. But if they have to reacquire, you're looking at a significant delay when prices rebound of potential capital being spent.
Okay. Lois, did you want to weigh in here?
Yes, I do. I want to talk a little bit about history being important, but there's also a number of factors going on right now that show that potentially we're not going to be talking about a short-term rebound in prices. In fact, there are a number of analysts that are all saying we're due for long-term, medium to long-term low-cost oil. And there are a number of reasons for that. The U.S. Use of oil has actually peaked. Other countries are likely to follow. We have the Paris talks that are going to take place in the next few months about climate change, and it'd be nice to sort of analyze how the bigger picture fits in terms of Alaska. And after the Paris meetings in December, we might have a better sense of where the world is going in terms of carbon-based fuels.
And Kara, impacts to the industry when the the lease situation changes?
I think, you know, as the commissioner mentioned, price doesn't really factor in as much on lease sales because you have to have the access before you can get to permitting and exploration and development. And I think if you look at the long lead times that the Arctic requires, who knows what prices are going to be, you know, assuming Shell would have continued to move forward, we weren't going to see production for 12 to 15 years. And so I'd give a dollar to anybody who can accurately predict oil prices 12 to 15 years from now. And I think, you know, to Lois's point, fossil fuels are going to continue to dominate the world demand. If you look at EIA estimates, 80% of the nation's consumption is still going to come from fossil fuels for the next 40 to 50 years. And so if you look at the opportunities of the Arctic and the long lead times and the fact that we don't know how long shale is going to be around in the lower 48, where is that next surge of production going to come from to supply America's needs? And I think if you need to have a consistent leasing program to give the industry certainty and predictability, I would argue the state of Alaska has a very robust and predictable lease sale system. We know when they're going to occur. They're very predictable. They're very timely. And so this turning on and turning off of lease sales, it's very hard for industry to plan that way.
Lois.
Yeah, and an additional point to remember is that no matter what the price of oil is, Alaska oil, especially Arctic oil, is always going to be relatively expensive compared to other places. There's a tremendous amount of shale oil, not just in North Dakota, but potentially there's going to be production of shale oil in South America, in Africa. The Iranian oil is likely to come onto the market, and it would be a big slug. So, you know, when you compare the cost of Alaska oil, where we're far away from markets, and we have some environmental protections in place that I think most people are comfortable with and think are important, Alaska isn't always going to look like the place that companies are going to turn to. So in terms of the state, and the question that we're addressing on the show, we are at potentially a transition point in the state where we have to start looking at alternative ways of ensuring our economy is sustained over the long run.
Yes, Mark Meyer.
Well, I appreciate this discussion. It's really a discussion the state's having. And now in terms of its fiscal position, low oil prices, dependency on single resources. We need to diversify our economy. That's clear. I don't think there's anyone who would argue differently. The challenge is how do you do it? And because diversification costs money. Diversification takes time. If we spend all our savings right now to do it, then we have no buffer. And we can't deliver the diversified economy. But our other resources can play an important role. And they do. But as you look at the models for diversification, one of the biggest points is we need to be using some of our savings accounts in the long run, right? That's kind of the consensus, is at least as a cushion, if nothing else, if oil prices do remain low. The ideal situation would be this conditions Norwegians, where their funds adequate to manage the savings, to manage much of the government functions. Ours is not. Ours is half the size. The only way really to grow it is not to spend a lot of it, which again leaves you with a deficit, so you need short-term cash, or to build it to the point. And what's built it is oil royalties. Mm-hmm. You know, right now 50% of our royalties go into it. So without oil production to build it, to get to sustainability, the pathway is very torturous and difficult. So we should also be investing in renewables. We should be clearly looking at our other industries and doing value added. We should be looking at intellectual capital and education, but all this costs money. Right now, the only way to really pay for that and that transition is through our fossil fuel energy sources. And I will share a little bit of the D.C. trip. You know, one of the things the governor recognized and discussed with the administration was the challenges of adaptation for our coastal communities. And the funding necessary to do that isn't forthcoming and won't be forthcoming from the federal government. So he brought up the issue of how do we build sustainability into it? Well, he has to have resources available through him. And some of the federal acreage, like ANWR, of course, with a 90% state royalty, would be a significant lift toward providing funds toward building out the necessary infrastructure and moving these villages and providing sustainability and also transitioning to new energy projects. So again, it's a chicken or egg kind of problem that we face. We need revenue to make the transition. We need education. We need these public services. At the same time, we need a way to pay for them. And we're not seeing that level of funding likely to be the federal government, which has their own budget problems.
Let's go to the phones for a call from Jim in Equoc. Good morning, Jim.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I have a very unpopular, suggestion. I'd suggested a while back is that, getting a couple $1 million out of a permanent fund to educate people, just for education. The thing is that, and that same light, we could, fund some solar, wind, and hydro projects throughout the state. And on the long run, if you could fund the university where they have trained people to be techs and jobs that are like preparing these solar panels or wind generation or hydro, have people trained to do that. And one way is there's a lot of money in some of these CDQ programs, and they could partnership with somebody CDQ. Because they afford a lot of dollars in education. If that was partnered up and we were to, like I say, raid the fund until our natural gas came online, it would really, because you're looking at all these other, I'll just give you one example. Look at the mental health funding that got cut by the legislature from 2009 to 2012. I saw a report that 32% of the budget was cut by the state. So now that's the result. Sorry, you're seeing how much people on the streets of Anchorage and on the streets of other places. This is our long term effect on our people here. So it's when you cut mental health funding, you're looking at there's suicide prevention programs. They're looking at places where these people could stay and the help that it provides. So that's something that, we really have to take a look at, and not look, but act on. We have to act on it right away.
So you're talking, you'd like to see more investment in education for future industry jobs that could be right here in the state?
Yeah, right in the state where we set up in rural Alaska, we could set up solar, wind and hydro, more projects throughout the state. But we want to educate people how to repair them too, not how to just put them out there and just leave them. And you might have a 20-year span on a wind project. But the thing is that you want to have somebody trained to repair that too.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you, Jim. Those are great, thoughtful comments. And we are talking today about what's the future going to look like for Alaska. How do we move from being heavily dependent on fossil fuels into a future that is more sustainable and stable for all Alaskans and for the planet? We will be talking about that and taking your calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the future of energy in the state and our dependence on it and what the future could look like in a more sustainable way. Let's go back to the phones just for a moment. We have Bill in Ketchikan. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thank you for accepting my call. I'm not a doom and gloom kind of guy. I'm really basically pretty optimistic. But on the other hand, I think that, you know, recognizing realities is a good idea. So in the last several years, the price of photovoltaics have gone down by half, and there are predictions that it will continue to fall. And there are predictions by pretty sophisticated people like the ex-head of Department of Energy for the country, that's going to be a total game changer. So it seems like about a year ago, the finance director for the state of Alaska was predicting that oil prices would be bound. But my question to the panel is, are we seriously considering what happens if these reductions in photovoltaics continue to happen and the whole energy market in the continental U.S. drops? What if oil continues to drop in price? Are we seriously considering that and having a scenario in that case? And I guess then the other maybe independent question is for them to respond to, if they're willing, would be, maybe it was partly responded to already, about developing, we are energy rich in other energy as well. Are we talking about developing other energy opportunities in the state of Alaska? Thank you.
Well, the photovoltaics question is interesting. What, how, you can't do a one-to-one comparison. I mean, the amount of energy that you can produce from solar and wind is not a direct one-off compared to the amount of energy that a gallon of oil or gas can create. So what does the future look like in that respect? Mark Myers?
Well, I think the caller brings up a lot of really important points, but there are a lot of different points embedded in there. So if you first want to look at the energy future of Alaska, Alaska is not well gridded, so we don't have infrastructure to transmit energy very effectively, and that is a killer for us. So the thought now is to look at places like Africa, places like Alaska that have ported and developed microgrids and systems, small systems, but with low population density. It's very expensive. So the holy grail isn't necessarily the generation of an interruptible supply. And again, much of our state is dark in the winter, and solar cells are only partially effective for part of the year, is storage. We need effective energy storage. We need to make a significant leap in battery technology and cost. And some of that's happening, but it needs to happen to a much greater extent, or other mechanisms for storage of interruptible supplies of energy. So we are coupling solar, wind, diesel. Our hydrokinetic systems are being developed, but in the winter, and debris flow issues with them make them challenging. So the university is a leader in the world in terms of these microgrid systems. Alaska Center for Energy and Power is working with many villages. Kodiak has a great wind success story. Mm-hmm. There are examples, but it's hard to meet consistent demand with interruptible supplies at this point. Some geothermal, some moderate geothermal at Chena. So all those need to be an important piece of the puzzle. One of the challenges is that cost reduction has to occur. And then as the previous caller talked about, we have to have educated people who can manage and maintain these systems. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you're currently in the communities that have enough populations that are isolated. The use of diesel fuel has created an infrastructure, which is not terribly efficient to use with renewables, so you have to rework these systems. Our diesel generators are designed for certain RPMs and efficiencies, and as you put more renewable, they become less efficient. So we are working on it. We're making remarkable progress in-state. On the larger national situation, you got to remember how we use energy. And the other thing is the developing world is using energy very differently. So you sort of, when you look at energy forecasts, you look at population growth, you look at energy demand, and you look at economic mobility that's moving up. So you have technology that's allowing you to use alternative sources. At the same time, you, in the long term, have growth of use of energy as economies develop and improve in around the world. And that's been the history of the world for more than 100, since the Industrial Revolution, that events have occurred. So efficiency is offset by increased usage. So as we develop the infrastructure, it's almost easier to start in a place where you have no infrastructure versus like the United States where you have an existing infrastructure. So there are real problems with long-term transport and electrical grid in the country. The scalability and accuracy of that is not that great. The other thing is, some of these other renewable sources have other environmental consequences, water use, wildlife, surface interface. Not that they aren't coming, but it's a really good thing that they are developing. And we have seen cars, the recession in the United States, We've seen a transition away from fossil fuels for transportation in many aspects, and we'll continue to see that. But it's not a complete process until efficiencies jump, and then we still need to generate and transmit the electricity, and we haven't built out the transmission grid to do that. So long and short is, I think he brings up a lot of good points. The path is longer than we would like. And then one last point is the level of investment to make the transition is significant. So often the cost goes down, the cycle time for payback of investment decreases, but it's still long term. And in Alaska, it's very long term. So it needs to be subsidized at this point to work. And are we willing to pay for the subsidies to make it work is one of the questions.
And Lois, I want to give you a chance to respond here. But if you're wanting to join our conversation about the future, the energy future of Alaska, you can call in statewide at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. Locally, the number is 550-8422 in Anchorage, 550-8422. Lois, the idea of investment in and subsidizing, where's the sweet spot? We have to, as we've heard, we're not going to move off fossil fuels overnight. It's going to be a long transition that will take time. But what is the subsidized mix for fossil fuel operations and investment and renewables?
Well, I don't have all the answers
right
to that kind of question, which really means everybody in the state needs to engage and discuss that. But I think one thing to add to the mix of what the commissioner said is that we have the potential for moving to renewables from an electricity standpoint. And Kodiak and Seward have been excellent examples of place-based use of renewables for electricity, Seward also for heating. We also have the use of fossil fuels for transportation, which while the efforts are ongoing to reduce that, and there are hybrid cars and electric vehicles and increased transit, we're still right now using fossil fuels quite a bit for transportation. That will be changing, and that's something the state has to essentially accept and recognize because those are the trends.
So we are currently in a very fossil fuel driven environment, and that's not going to change as we've been talking about for quite a while yet. But we're moving in new directions at the same time. Kara, in the immediate sense, with the price of oil hovering around $50 per barrel as it's been for this past year, what are the impacts that you're seeing to employees in the industry here, in the fossil fuel oil industry here? What's the reality of what's happening in Prudhoe Bay and across the state for producers who maybe, you know, there's been discussion about did the oil tax breaks inspire more production? Or because of the price of oil, are companies laying folks off?
Well, I think, you know, to go to both points, you know, as we move to renewables and other energy supplies, the transition period is going to be very long. I just think we need to recognize that, you know, we don't have the grid. It takes a lot of infrastructure. The research isn't there. You have to subsidize these resources. And so the transition period is not over the next decade. The transition period is much longer than that. So what is going to sustain Alaska's economy in the meantime? And we would argue that's a strong oil and gas industry. And right now at lower prices, the theme of the day in the industry is efficiency and cost containment. And tax credits have incentivized increased investment and production and jobs. And it's good that we've had those here. And it's good that we've had a different tax climate because since the tax was changed in April of 2013, we've seen $5 billion more of investment than we wouldn't have had. And some of those projects are still moving forward under this low price environment. Kalis has a project called Nunat, which could add up to 10,000 to 15,000 barrels per day. They're moving forward with that project. ConocoPhillips just started production in MPRA. Repsol, even though there's some ownership change and a delay in that project, they haven't shelved that project. And so I think as we look to the future and what the industry is facing right now, it's no different than if your and I's family budget had been reduced in half And that's basically what has happened to the industry. It's basically taking like a dual income household to going to a one income household. You're not going out to dinner as often, and you're making those hard choices, and those tennis shoes are going to last a little longer. And so those are types of choices that the industry's faced with, and there have been some job layoffs, and there will not be as many jobs on the slope this winter as last winter, but there are still projects that are moving forward that are important, and we need to have a stable oil and gas industry, or you're never going to be able to transition effectively without totally draining the state's resources, because where is the resources going to come from to build out that increased infrastructure?
I want to give Lois a chance to respond again to this idea that we aren't going to transition very quickly. Do you think that Alaskans need to accept the idea that we are in a post-oil boom climate environment and that we need to just more quickly find a way forward off of what has been our bacon, our bread and butter for many decades now? Does there need to be a stepped-up effort in that regard, Lois?
Well, if you look at the information about the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, for example, there have been a number of court cases that have shown that it's likely to continue operating for the next few decades. I don't disagree with that. The ownership of the pipeline and the producers on the North Slope overlap almost completely, and the investment is there. So we are going to continue producing on the North Slope, largely on state lands and waters, for quite a while. So we don't have to pretend that that's going to stop in the very near future. In terms of the natural gas pipeline, I think one fact that a lot of people are not aware is that while it will certainly bring in revenue to the state, the predictions are that the net revenue will be something like 1.2 to 1.5 billion a year, because we have to pay off debt service and lots of other costs. So while that will be something the state is moving towards, it's not going to be by any means a silver bullet in terms of revenue. And that is likely to start producing the revenue in maybe 2025. So that's still quite a bit away. We're in a tough period right now. Until we get to that point, and even when we get to that point, that's not going to be enough when we have a $3 billion-plus deficit each year right now, and costs only go up, as we all know.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Jeremy is in Anchorage and wants to have a comment about ANWR. Jeremy?
Thank you. You know, that last comment segues perfectly into the question that I had, that 25 years away silver bullet response from Lois, because that was the justification given by President Clinton when he vetoed ANWR in 1995. So my thoughts are, first, yes, we do have to look long term, but the oil and gas industry, the resource development industry, is going to help finance those energy projects in Alaska, rural Alaska, hydro in southeast, wind in southwest. And I think the oil and gas future of the state, the future of our state, is still going to be in oil and gas for decades to come. And with the departure of companies out of the Arctic and the decline in throughput and taps and the decline in the fields in the North Slope, the only real prolific formation left in the state is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is, you know, that 1002 area. So the question I have is, given what we know now that the president, we would have ANWR producing, you know, right now if it weren't for President Clinton back in 95. As we look forward, can we agree, you know, the three of you on the panel, can we agree that if ANWR was producing, you know, 10, 15 years from now, that would be a significant boon to our state's economy?
Well,
can we agree?
I obviously would very much agree with that. I mean, the prediction.
I doubt we'll have consensus on this point.
Well, but I do think that the estimates are that ANWR is a 10 billion barrel field in the 1002 area, and I think it's important for listeners across the state to remember that over 80% of ANWR is already permanently off limits for development. And so what the question is a small parcel called the 1002 area. So we're not talking about opening up the entire Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So I think that's an important point to remember. And in that 1002 area, we think there's 10 billion barrels of oil. And we've produced 17 billion barrels to date and counting from Prudhoe. So it is a significant resource. And the estimates are it would provide about 1 million barrels per day. It would very much help the pipeline. More throughput helps the costs and keeping the costs down, because right now it's more expensive to produce 500,000 barrels per day than 1 million barrels per day. So all of those factors would go in play, not to mention the jobs and so forth. So for me, yeah, very much so. Unfortunately, that's not up to Alaskans to decide. But I think it's important to remember that the majority of Alaskans do support opening that coastal plain.
And I'm assuming, Mr. Myers, that you would agree that opening ANWR would be good for the state's economy.
Certainly, this is an issue that, you know, I've been involved with probably for more than 20 years, testified for Congress many times on it, and have discussions with this administration and previous administrations as well. And clearly, the oil and gas potential is high. We don't know, again, how much. The mean USGS undiscovered resource estimate's about 10 billion barrels, as we said. And the low end is about 3, 4 billion. The high end is about 16. So it's a very, very large number. It looks very, very attractive with the development of Point Thompson. A pipeline is adjoining the area. So some of the infrastructure questions have been answered. I think, you know, looking at it objectively, you can look at a lot of mitigation measures where surface disturbance. So it's about 8% of the refuge in the coastal plain. I think very focused exploration activities that would disturb a few thousand acres of land maximum, but done right way with really strong directional drilling, seasonal drilling restrictions during periods of caribou activity. And, for instance, in the 1002 area, they, in the last 15 years, haven't used it much for calving, and then they use the eastern portion when they do. And so there are parts that are more environmentally sensitive for caribou and others. Migratory waterfowl, the other issue, birds are there part of the time and not the others. So when we look at the toolbox, if you were to create a series of mitigation measures and stipulations, I believe, based on the best science that I've seen, that you can mitigate most of the wildlife effects. So it's really an ideological discussion about wilderness versus non-wilderness. And then there's the issue of what do the people that live on the North Slope think about it? And so getting that opinion. So realistically, it is a huge opportunity for the state that's gotten embroiled in national politics on both sides of the issue. And I would like to see us go back and sort it out with the best available science and approaches. Can I say one other thing real quick? Mm-hmm. That is the Arctic landscape, again, with this ownership of the federal government, state government, native corporations, could be creatively structured where we could actually enhance wildlife and wilderness values while increasing development, I believe. If you look at the chessboard, there are real opportunities for us to compare our land positions, to do strategic trades maybe, but to look at joint use management for enhancing ecosystems and species at the same time. With the state taking a greater focus on economic development, the federal government taking the strong emphasis on conservation. You know, our mission, again, at the state is clearly to develop and conserve. We're not the resource and balance those things. But I think if we look at the toolbox we have, there are tremendous opportunities like the coastal plain of ANWR that could be done on a win-win basis overall for the state's environment and for species and for wilderness.
Let's give Lois a chance to, I would assume that you have a counter-argument here.
Yeah, I do. Our position is that there are some places that are too special to drill, and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge's coastal plain is one of those places. The second largest caribou herd in the state calves and nurses and avoids insects in that area. While there are mitigating measures that take place on the North Slope to avoid some of the impacts on caribou, there are going to be real impacts. There are going to be impacts to subsistence users in those areas. I think something we could all agree on is that not all places are equal in terms of their values. And the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is pretty much the top of the pyramid in terms of sensitivity. So where you do something, how you do something, those are all factors. But there are some areas that are just too special.
We are going to take just a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about the NPRA and also Shell Offshore and what happened as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Linfield College in Oregon offers degrees in the arts, sciences, and professional programs, and a rich campus life with athletics, music, study abroad, and more. Linfield College representatives are visiting area high schools in Anchorage, Kenai, and Fairbanks the week of October 20th. Learn more at linfield.edu. This message sponsored by Linfield College.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Kara, you mentioned earlier that there's some development going on in the NPRA. North Dakota and Alberta, our producers seem to be going after tar sands oil, shale oil. Some of that oil is heavier and poorer quality. I've been told that the NPRA oil isn't all that whippy either, that it's harder to get out, that it's heavier. What's the reality about the cost compared to the benefit of trying to get at some of that?
Well, I think if you look at the National Petroleum Reserve, it was designated a petroleum reserve back in the 20s by President Harding, and it's exciting that we're finally seeing some development from that. I think that it doesn't matter where in Alaska you drill, whether it's MPRA or Kuparuk or Prudhoe or eventually in Anwar, it's going to be more expensive than drilling in North Dakota or Texas. It just is. The wells are more expensive. The drilling rigs are more expensive. Everything is more expensive. But as you look at how are we going to supply Alaska's needs and the America's needs, you're going to eventually need it all. And I think when we talk about production from MPRA, it is a potential resource. Now, it's limited because the federal government has put off limits the higher prospectivities of the region, but we are excited to see finally, after a long, lengthy permitting litigation process, production from that area.
Lois?
Yeah, I think another thing to remember about the National Petroleum Reserve is that it is, in fact, very poorly named. It does not have as much petroleum as was once thought, and also it does have those very sensitive areas. And in the 70s, there was another statute that applied that Congress actually, Petroleum Reserve is going to have a multiple use mandate and that there are some areas that need to be protected. So it is not just a petroleum reserve.
Can we talk a little bit about the NPRA, but also as it relates to the idea of what is available, USGS estimates, industry estimates? What's known about what Shell didn't find? There was the potential, or there was an assumption that there was a lot of oil in that area. We're looking at the NPRA talking about that right now. What's the reality of why there wasn't more in this area that they thought was should have been the sweet spot?
Okay. So if you look at the geology, again, if you have a map of the North Slope in your kind of in your head, on the eastern side in MPRA, it's very gaseous in source. So the reservoirs are there, but it's more gas than oil. And the last USGS assessment greatly downgraded the amount of oil there and increased the amount of gas potential there. So we know from the drilling that gas is the primary hydrocarbon that you're likely to encounter, but there is some oil, minimum oil, in relatively small accumulations that we know of. As you move offshore the Chukchi Sea, though, we know a couple things. One is we have some the initial well data, including the last Shell well. Again, you cannot make or condemn. You can condemn a basin if you don't have any of the key geological elements, if you don't have a source rock, a source of oil, if you don't have reservoir rock, and if you don't have some way to trap the oil. And then the timing of creation of oil and migration into the trap is important. So those four elements are the key. What we knew from the Berger well drilled in 1991 is that we had a trap and we had gas in the top. And Shell believed in that specific trap below that gas cap, which is very large, about 14 trillion cubic feet, again, almost about half the size of the Prudhoe gas cap. It's a huge worldwide supply of conventional gas. But below that, Shell believed they had billions of barrels of oil. So often in a reservoir, they're like a layer cake, water at the base, oil in the middle, and gas at the top. What had happened in that lower part, there was oil there, but the oil leaked out and the gas remained in the upper part of the structure. So just in that one particular case, we verified really good reservoir, we verified source rock, we verified oils in the basin, and we oil really big structures. So that all that last well proves is that particular prospect, one among many in a very large area, is not productive. And that's typical. So it really doesn't tell us much about the basin. It confirms the geologic elements are there. It doesn't say the basin isn't good. So the USGS numbers, I think, total on the North Slope in terms of undiscovered resource, not including our heavy oil or proven stuff, about 3 billion barrels of proven reserves in addition to the heavy oil, about 20 billion barrels of heavy oil in place, about 30 billion of additional oil on the North Slope, onshore and offshore, majority of that in the offshore, but still a significant amount in the onshore, particularly in the Anwar side. So a lot of resource, more than about double what we produced is what the USGS estimates there that's technically recoverable.
Now, if oil is migrating out of an area that was previously tested, what's the shelf life of seismic testing then?
So when we look at oil migration, we typically look at things that occurs over tens of thousands to millions of years
okay.
in time, right? So
right.
So what happened is we don't know when, because we don't have the data, when that oil leaked out. It could be relatively recent. It could be millions of years ago.
Interesting.
So the geologists in oil, you have to look at why you call it a non-renewable resource is it renews at very, very slow rates. We also know that oil migrates from part of the basin where it's created. So you take the rock, it's like an oven, you have to bury it to the place where the temperature increases and pressure increases to generate the hydrocarbons out of the carbon that's stored. Then that carbon that's stored then gets to a certain point of time where it's mature, it cooks to oil, and then it has to either stay in that place or it moves out of that place. Typically, it moves out of that place, which is the shale, and then migrates into upstream, some of it which gets captured in reservoirs that have traps with them.
All right, we only have about 30 seconds left. Any final comments, Lois, from you, and then Kara?
Yeah, in terms of the state's economy, it's clear that Alaskans are smart, we're resilient. We'll figure this out as long as everybody engages.
All right, thank you. And Kara, a final comment from you.
Well, I think as we look at the economy, I think we are still going to be an oil and gas state as we transition. So I think that's really important, and I hope that will continue.
Thank you so much to my guests, Mark Myers, the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, Kara Moriarty, the President and CEO of Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and Lois Epstein, who is a petroleum engineer and also Arctic Program Manager.
This member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.